Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. We got another great episode for you today. I'm Kevin.
I'm Jason.
And I'm Scott.
Scott, what's on the OR schedule for today?
Well, we're very excited today to have Dr. Heidi Nelson, who is the chairman of surgery and professor of surgery at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. She's going to tell us a little bit about her approach to recurrent rectal cancer. She's also going to tell us her approach and tips and tricks regarding how she positions and defines the anatomy in the recurrent pelvis. We're going to talk a little bit about leadership challenges that she's faced, and then embark a little bit more upon the COST trial, of which she was the leading author of that New England Journal of Medicine publication.
Great. And as always, we want this to be interactive. So be sure to visit us on our website, behindtheknife.org. Find us on Facebook. Hit us up on Twitter, at Behind the Knife. Well, that sound means it's time for our random fact of the day.
Well, I know a lot of you out there have had problems associated with chapped lips, keelitis, stomatitis, or God forbid, that awful cold sore that takes up half your mouth.
Awful problem.
So you're out there, you're looking for camphor, you're looking for Burt's beadwax, you're looking for lots of different ointments and salves that you can put on to aid in the help of chapped lips. In the old days, actually, it's very interesting. Jay, what did they used to use in the old days?
I don't know, but I'm sure it was something disgusting.
It can't get more disgusting than this. They actually used to use earwax, which was used as a lip balm prior to the invention and mass marketing of chapstick and chapstick products. And this really happened by one Charles Brown Fleet in the 1880s, who lived from 1843 to 1916. And his company, CB Feet, was founded in Lynchburg, Virginia, and still operates today. But it's probably more known today for one specific product. And what is that, Jay?
So this is a Fleet's enema.
Absolutely, because it always comes back to the anus.
And that has been your random fact of the day.
Well, welcome to Behind the Knife. We are absolutely thrilled to have Dr. Heidi Nelson, who is the Fred C. Anderson Professor of Surgery and the Chair of the Department of Surgery at Mayo Clinic College of Medicine in Rochester, Minnesota. For those of you who don't know, Dr. Nelson has been funded by the NIH, the American Cancer Society, the American Society of Colorectal Surgeons, in addition to many other organizations. Dr. Nelson, thank you so much for joining us here on Behind the Knife.
Pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
So your CV is pretty impressive and pretty awesome. For those of you that are out there that aren't as familiar with your background, can you just walk us a little bit through where you're from, where you trained, and how you got to the point where you're at Mayo now?
Right. So I grew up in Los Angeles, the daughter of an aerospace engineer and a social worker, but we migrated up to Washington State, where I did my medical school at University of Washington, and then down to Portland, where I did my surgical training, and then somehow managed to get out to Mayo Clinic in Rochester, where I trained in colorectal surgery and never left the Midwest, which is peculiar, but it's been a very fulfilling career thus far, so I'm pleased that that happened.
So, ma'am, we were wondering, you were one of the lead authors of this a large surgical study that was published in the New England Journal called the COST trial. Can you tell us what the process is like of organizing and being involved in a study of that magnitude?
That was obviously probably the pinnacle of my career in terms of experiences with research and collaboration at a national level. It was just by luck, I happened to be the person in Rochester at Mayo who was tapped to develop laparoscopic colectomy, and the biggest concern out there was that for cancer of the colon, you really maybe shouldn't do laparoscopic surgery. So we really needed to go forward with some kind of scientific evidence testing whether laparoscopic surgery was okay in cancer, and some of the data at the time suggested it might not be, that pneumoperitoneum might spread tumor cells abnormally and promote cancer growth rather than be effective like traditional surgery had. So I was familiar with scientific method. I've been involved with clinical research and clinical trials through my surgical oncology training in Oregon, and I also had really excellent surrounding collaborative environment at Mayo, a lot of involvement in the cooperative groups already, even though it's just 3 years on staff. And I found my way to being able to ask the question through a clinical trial. I had connections with a fabulous statistician and with a group, a well-organized group to do clinical trials. Plus, I really had some senior mentorship from across the United States helping me navigate the rather challenging regulatory systems and the monetary systems and funding systems to get the support I really needed to pull it together. So it was just a great time for a single question about cancer and laparoscopy to coalesce. There was another great benefit is that a lot of surgeons were willing to participate. 48 institutions and some 63 surgeons That's said, amazing. Sign me up. And what sign me up meant was a lot of work and a lot of exposure. So nobody had really probably looked at somebody else's videos and operating in the way that we did, say you're going to get credentialed or you're not going to get credentialed to participate in this study. And surgeons stepped up to the plate, volunteered to do this work, which was a heavy lift, and participated at the highest standards you can imagine. And I can't be more pleased to have been sort of the one who helped lead it. It was a team effort. That's what if you look at the New England Journal authorship list, in fact, my name isn't first. It's the writing team and then the whole team. That performed that trial, and you know it was a lot of first activities came out of it, such as video recording, auditing that, credentialing people with that, and other aspects of the trial, like the quality of life part of the trial was fairly unique. The economic aspect was unique as well. So it was a great time. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of work, but it was fun work.
Yeah, I'm curious about that. When you look back on the cost trial and you look back, my question is threefold. What are your memories? I mean, what kind of, I'm sure it's something with that much work into it. It's almost visceral. What was the hardest part of it, but putting it together or writing it and what was maybe one of the more fun aspects? And then finally, were you at all concerned when the actual results came out and you were presenting it and going around and doing it all that there'd be backlash or that people would not support this? Or what were your thoughts about that entire process?
So I think the heaviest lift in the process was really keeping it moving forward. I mean, I think the study, if I remember right, was 7 years in the accrual phase. And, you know, we got started off with a bang and there's sort of that general enthusiasm in the beginning, and as a trial goes on, it fatigues. People fatigue. Mm-hmm. You know, you forget. Oh, that's right. I got to put a patient on the trial, and you know it. You don't. It feels like a lot of work at first, but I tell you, I learned so much from my colleagues, and I also learned a lot from patients. You know, when you ask somebody to participate in a trial, it feels very personal because you're really opening up, you know, yourself to them, saying, you know, look, we don't know if laparoscopy is going to be okay. Would you participate in a, sort of this experiment? It might sound like mm-hmm. to make sure that it is okay, and we're gonna make sure that we watch the risk and we manage the risk so that we're not putting you at undue risk. But patients participate every day, and the generosity of the patients and their willingness to contribute towards scientific advancement was absolutely eye-opening for me. And that's when I started engaging in much more of a dialogue with patients as equal participants and understood the value of that much more after that trial than I ever did before. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was only 3 years on staff, so I think a lot of that you learn as a staff, but I think my learning process was accelerated because of the cost mm-hmm. trial. As far as the results go, I think people knew it was a very rigorous trial, that it had all the bells and whistles and a real high standard. So I didn't really have a lot of concerns that people wouldn't agree with the results or accept the results, but implementing the results, that was another story. It's still not widely adopted because it does take time to learn how to do the procedure. And if you're only a casual operator, for colon surgery, you're not likely to want to switch your techniques and go through that, because it does, it took me a tremendous amount of time to learn the procedure and then to teach the people around me and to get good, experienced first assistants doing it. So, I had to train a lot of nurses, train a lot of residents, train a lot of, people in the operating room. I had to learn a lot myself. I mean, the whole technical transformation was probably the worst of the grunt work right there.
So going forward now, what do you think the real, the lasting impact of the cost trial is going to be?
Well, it answered a fundamental question that was probably going to be the single greatest barrier to laparoscopy, which is whether it promotes cancer in a way that's substantially different than open surgery. By answering that question the way we did, it really, I think, put to rest that question. Mm-hmm. So that question didn't have to get asked and answered for gastric cancer, pancreas cancer, every other cancer. I think it really was just a fundamental cancer question that we were able to resolve in such a way that I think it satisfied the need to know for most practitioners, and everybody could move forward without that being the number one gatekeeper.
Did you always target the New England Journal, obviously from the academic standpoint, to get the widest dissemination on it? And maybe a bit of a more generalized question is for the younger residents that listen to the podcast, what are your thoughts upon, you got a paper, how do you try to match a paper with an impact factor with with a particular journal? Do you aim high in the beginning and then kind of work your way down depending on the review, or do you not waste that time and try to target the exact journal that you're going for where you think it might fall into place?
Yeah, that's a good question, trying to find the right journal. It's all about the audience, who's going to give you the right audience and where does that message need to be heard. It wasn't my intent to go after New England Journal, but once we had the results and I knew that it was a really important clinical question a lot of people were interested in, so I thought it would have the impact that it in fact did have, and so it turned out to be the right place for the paper. As regards how should a resident approach a journal, I think anytime you want to reach higher than you probably can land, but you don't want to overreach in an extreme way that makes you waste your time or make it seem unreasonable. So, for example, 10%, 15% stretch is always a bit reasonable. If you overstate a conclusion a little bit, you're going to be forgiven. If you wildly overstate a conclusion, you're not going to be, you're going to be thought to be a little bit off. So I think the same is true for anything. I mean, you always, when a resident looks at a fellowship program, you try to find something that's going to be just maybe a little bit out of your reach, because maybe it's not out of your reach. But you don't want to go extremely out of your reach. And I think, again, who is going to be interested? And you can simply, if you're looking at publications, thumb through the journal, look at what's already there. You'll get a sense of whether the topics are going to, your topic is going to resonate with the existing topics.
So you've been in a number of leadership roles. Can you talk about some of the challenges that you've had and how you've overcome them? And then specifically, as a leading woman in surgery, what advice would you give to young female surgeons who not only want to be great clinical surgeons, but also want to pursue leadership roles?
Right. So easier to sort of quickly answer the second question about my advice to women in surgery. It's really the same as my advice to men in surgery, is follow your passion, know who you are, write a personal statement, a mission, if you will, and live it every day, because every day adds up to years, and at the end of the at the end of the time, it's all about your life. I mean, for surgeons, you put so much time into becoming a surgeon that it becomes almost a definition for you. It defines who you are. And I don't think of that as a bad thing. I think to provide what patients need, you really have to dedicate yourself. So the length of the training is appropriate. The amount of time you have to spend to become a master and to do justice to the sort of the trauma you commit on patients every day, it really, all that adds up and it matters. So if it's not your passion, don't do it. Find your passion. Find the right balance that makes sense for you. For women in particular, I think they do bring a different perspective, just like, as has been pointed out in the book, you know, who's from Venus and who's from Mars. I don't know which one exactly those are because I don't really know Mars and Venus that well either. But I would say that there are differences between men and women, just like I think there are individual differences between each person. Mm-hmm. And I think what women have brought is an opportunity to open our eyes to the individuality of people. And, you know, I used to think that it was really not possible for women to have families. Of course, I changed my mind. I have a family. So that came to me later in my career that I came to understand you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, you can't necessarily do it all at one time. You have to find where your strengths are, what your passions are, and sort of map it out accordingly. And you know, don't try to overdo it, but, you know, don't necessarily limit yourself. As far as leadership, what have I learned? The greatest challenge in leadership has been to learn that what it takes to get you to have the credibility and the position of a leader is not the same thing as what it takes to really be a leader. You're not born a leader. You work at being a leader. It takes a lot of time. It takes help from others. It takes a tremendous amount of personal awareness and insight, and it kind of boils down to what got you here, meaning to get to the leadership position isn't what's going to get you to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
Overachieving is what it took to kind of get credibility, to get the visibility, like with the cost trial. It gave me tremendous visibility, like it or not. It gave me a lot of visibility, but that was a very overachieving activity, watching videos for hours on Saturday. I'm going on tons of trips. I can't tell you, I actually cleaned out the archives of all the communications from all the websites and all the minutes. Probably at least a few trees and maybe a small forest went into that activity, as I was reminded recently when I had to discard it all. It was a lot of work, but it taught me a lot. It was a labor of love, but it was overachieving. Now I know that I need to, and I do, focus on people. I've become more of a servant leader. I want to make other people successful. I want other people to get fulfilled. It's about building high-performance teams and about serving other people.
Ma'am, I know one of your personal research interests has been the gut microbiome. And can you just give us a little review of where we are and what we can look forward to in the future and possible clinical applications?
Right. The gut microbiome is a phenomenal new frontier. It is so exciting and so amazing that we have so little knowledge of the whole genome that we don't even think about day to day. It's contained within the microbes in our system. So our genome is pale in comparison to the genome of the bugs within us. You know, we are totally populated by microbial cells all over our body in every niche. There's 9 different microenvironments within the mouth, for example. And we live symbiotically with them. So, for example, in the gut microbes, the microbes in our gut help us harvest energy. The microbes in our gut help us harvest vitamins and cofactors. They do a lot of the work for us that we can't do for ourselves. And we're starting to learn that they participate in a number of sort of the development of diseases through like neurotransmitters, metabolites that are actually neurotransmitters that may act locally on the immune system, like creating motility, or systemically. And there's a gut-brain axis, in fact, where what goes on in your gut does actually affect what's happening in your brain through these molecules that get into the circulation. So let me go back and give some examples. So energy harvest. So if you take a mouse and you make it germ-free by sterilizing it right at birth, and then you keep it sterile in a bubble, like a bubble mouse, then if you watch its weight, then you add in bugs, gut bugs, either mouse or human, then that mouse, despite the same activities, same food, is going to gain 30% weight.
Hmm.
And there is a microbiome profile that goes with obesity, and you can transfer that obesity profile.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the reverse of that. So the gut microbiome that helps somebody gain weight is different from the microbiome that keeps people from gaining weight when they're malnourished. So a large experiment done in Africa showed that if you take malnourished kids and you want to reverse the malnutrition with food, like peanut butter, supercharged food, it doesn't work so well. But when you give them antibiotics and then you feed them that food, then they can gain the weight. So you have to alter the microbiome in order to reverse the malnutrition. So it's true that what you eat in calories and what you do for exercise, whether you know sedentary or not, does influence your weight, no question about that. But it's probably modified. We know it's modified by the microbiome, maybe 30% of the equation. I don't know what the exact numbers are, and it's probably different for every person, but we're starting to understand that the microbiome does contribute. Another example is gut motility. You take those the same bubble mice, germ-free mice, and you look at their gut contractility. There's very few signals. There's very few motor complexes that migrate down the gut, peristalsis, if you want to call it that. But when you introduce the human microbiome into the gut, all of a sudden you see the contractility go up, the propulsions go up, and the transit time goes down. So, we think that's, through things like serotonin and other neurotransmitters that exist within the gut. And so that starts to explain how those same substances may actually go systemic, right? And then there are some animal models that show depression and anxiety can be diet and microbiome related.
So
autism can be, affected by the gut microbiome.
So maybe a very basic question, though, but then so when we introduce things such as disinfectants, Listerine, or colon cleansing for colonoscopy and stuff, have you looked and seen how that affects the microbiome? And is it just that they're already so set up that it really doesn't? Or is that leading into even worse C. diff in patients or other types of problems that you're exploring or anything along those lines?
Right. So you can think about the gut microbiome as being much like an ecology system, right? So it could be like Yellowstone's river ecology, or it could be, any ecologic system you studied, in school. Most of it's going to be preserved. So if you wash out the gut, it's going to kind of be repopulated. Now, I can imagine that as a colorectal surgeon that, a lot of the microbes are going to be on the lining, right? So there's a number of different microenvironments within the gut. There's what's in the lumen, which is going to get washed away. There's the mucosal layers, which are alternating positive and negative. And then there's the epithelial layer. So there's a whole number of layers within which the microbes probably exist. And they're probably a little bit different, but there's probably a feeder system that if you wash away what's in the lining or in the lumen, the lining is probably going to repopulate it pretty quickly. So we do know from some longitudinal data on individuals that if you go to Mexico and you get, a traveler's diarrhea, that you're going to pretty much repopulate afterwards. But the problem is if you keep hitting that system chronically, like chronic antibiotics, then you can tip the balance in favor of something like C. diff, which, of course, we know can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question really is, how does that microbiome get set? And probably, this is a bunch more conjectural right now, but it's probably set between the time of delivery, when you're populated with, through the vaginal birth canal, we know, and mother's milk, and then table food, and then the food off, the dirt your kids eat, and the stuff they get exposed to, and preschool, sharing of germs, and all that kind of stuff. So you pretty much get your microbiome set probably by age 3, and then it stabilizes. So probably the first 3 years, it's all over the place because your exposures are all over the place. And that kind of resonates with probably what happens with the immunologic reaction to the microbiome, sorting out, well, which of these bugs should I just get used to? What can we call, part of my body versus what parts really don't belong with me? The immune system is developing at the same time after childbirth. So we know there's probably a pretty well regulated response between the human genome, the microbial genome, and then the immune system of the person. It all kind of gets set up like a rheostat.
Great, ma'am. Well, now it's time for our dissection of the day, and this is the segment of the podcast where we delve more in depth about a particular surgical topic, and today we've decided to talk about the patient with recurrent rectal cancer. So I was wondering if you could just talk to us a little bit about how you approach that patient, that has a recurrent rectal cancer. How do you decide, that kind of that decision tree between a palliative treatment versus a curative treatment versus, nothing at all? And how do you have that conversation with the patient?
Very complicated subject, and one I've spent 27 years on, trying to simplify it, reduce it. Some of it can be reduced to simple principles, and some of it's harder, and it's been a moving target in my career. So I would say first, it's not for the faint at heart. Simple recurrences like an anastomotic recurrence, I don't really put in the same category as the real difficult recurrences. An anastomotic recurrence, I think, is a fairly, straightforward redo operation, maybe from a low anterior resection to an APR or something like that. The recurrences that I'm typically dealing with are where they're stuck to structures that may or may not be amenable to resection. The pelvis is a complicated structure that has, bony landmarks and doesn't collapse well. And so there's nerves and arteries and veins running through it that go from the thorax and the abdomen and the retroperitoneum down into the extremity. So it's a busy, busy place. And you're trying to preserve function without, and also treat the cancer successfully. So sometimes those things bump up against each other, and actually quite a bit they bump up against each other because it's all about the location. Something near the sciatic nerve is going to be challenging. The sidewall is always challenging. If you have something against the uterus, that's really not a big deal. You take out the uterus and the rectum. If you have something up against the bladder, you can take out the bladder. It's when you have something that's touching the ischial spine, the sacrum, and the bladder, or the prostate, you're trying to go, okay, can I get clearance on this? It's also the problem and challenge is that they're not clear anatomy. It's not like a primary rectal cancer where you can say, I know where the epicenter of the cancer is. I know where it starts. These have a very fuzzy boundary that's not like a clear-cut line that you can say, here's where it starts and here's where it stops. Even histologically, during surgery, you can take a piece of tissue, send it for frozen section, which we do all the time, and which there's at least a 90% accuracy for, and it's very hard with frozen section or even permanent section to look at the margins because, if you have 200 cells on a slide, and only one of them is cancer, is not going to be seen. The resolution is not sufficient. Mm-hmm. So you can still have cancer, and it could be meaningful cancer that comes back, but it's hard to find it grossly or on x-ray or even histologically. So the boundaries are often hard to see, particularly in the field of fibrosis. What's fibrosis? What's cancer? What's cancer in fibrosis? So those are really the challenges. And then getting into the pelvis on a redo is never easy or fun, because you've got to try to find all the critical structures and preserve them as much as you can, unless you've accepted that you're going to remove, you know, hemipelvis, or, you know, certainly removing the sacrum is fairly straightforward up to S1 and S2. But beyond that, it gets to be challenging. So
when you have specifically these patients that have this recurrence, now you have somebody that has it, can you talk a little bit about how you decide on a surgical option? You know, is there, we talked a little bit earlier in the opening shot about local excision. Is there ever a local excision for, these particular patients? Does everybody get an APR? Is there a role for minimally invasive surgery in these recurrent rectal cancers?
So I can't say that I've ever seen a patient who could have their recurrence done with either local excision, which is usually how they get into the problem in the first place. It can be the tumor being a problem, or it can be the prior surgery being, you know, not adequate or not enough, even though it was the standard of care. What was the other question you asked about? Oh, laparoscopic. No, most of the time, so you can actually have a recurrence within fibrosis. You put a laparoscope down, you don't even see it.
Mm-hmm.
They're not masses that necessarily stand out. They're not like you're going to open up the abdomen and boom, there it is, and you pluck it out. Mm-hmm. They're not plucking. It's more like digging things out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've ever seen an x-ray on a patient who's had pelvic surgery, there's usually a fairly thick amount of fibrosis in the pelvis right in front of the sacrum. It could be anywhere from a few millimeters, which is pretty rare, to several centimeters thick. I've probably carved out with 4 centimeters worth of fibrosis before you get to the sacrum in some cases, because I've had prior radiation, mm-hmm. because I've had prior surgery, and if there's nothing to fill that tissue in, fibrosis does the job instead.
Mm-hmm. So when do you consider providing these patients with radiation therapy or intraoperative radiation therapy or even brachytherapy?
Right. So anytime a margin is going to be difficult, let's say it's right up against the ischial spine, let's say it covers a large part of the presacrum and the pelvic sidewall, and you really just, short of taking a hemipelvectomy or hemicorporectomy, you're not going to get it out, then we would use intraoperative radiation therapy, because it's going to extend your margin. And you have to give external beam radiation first to kind of get the dose generally up to a certain amount, and then use intraoperative radiation therapy to boost that dose in a specific location, and you get a much higher delivery and a much greater kill rate if you do it intraoperatively. But you need both doses, external and internal, intraoperatively to really get an effective kill, because you need 6,000 rads to get a killing dose based on the biology of radiation therapy. So 6,000 rads you can't get externally, and 6,000 rads internally is going to like burn a hole in the patient too. So you do them both sort of separated a little bit in time, but you do them together and they're going to give you a better biologic impact. What was the other question?
Kind of along those same lines, can you talk to us a little bit about the multidisciplinary approach, how you sit down in your tumor board or with your oncologist and decide when you're going to give neoadjuvant up front on the recurrent cancers versus somebody you're going to approach surgically first? Or how do you go about that whole kind of just generalized theme?
Yeah, generally speaking, you take the cancer and you sort out what's the most life-threatening part of the cancer. Do they have a systemic recurrence? If they've got disease in the liver and the lungs, let's say, then the local recurrence isn't probably very important. You need to get systemic control, because if you might win a battle and lose the war. So you really have to look at the whole picture. You know, how healthy is the patient? Are they going to withstand a lot of treatment? Because this is like a treatment marathon. You want to look at the whole picture. Do they, you know, looking for systemic disease, looking at the extent of local disease, is it resectable? Can you get an R0 resection? You can take out some things. Vessels, you can take out and replace them. Bladders, you can take out and make a conduit. Uterus, as I mentioned, you can take out. You can basically take everything out of the pelvis. But when you get into the pelvic structures themselves, you really start getting a little bit more out of balance. But that's where you bring in, you know, your radiation, you know, colleagues. You do it all up front, and you do the medical oncology colleagues. Okay, what's the role of chemotherapy? You know, you're always going to put radiation chemotherapy together if you're giving radiation therapy because you get a better impact. But let's say you thought maybe there might be some, you're uncertain about some nodules in the liver and you think they're real, or maybe there's some more nodes and you're not sure. Sometimes you could treat them with chemotherapy to make sure no additional disease emerges. I mean, that's not typical. But if you're going to, you have to decide, are you going for R0? You're going to go to take everything out, like a pelvic recurrence and a liver recurrence or a lung recurrence. Do you think you could get it all out surgically and then follow with chemotherapy? Or if you're not really certain and you think there's more disease than you expect and it's not clearly going to be an R0 resection, then maybe you go with chemotherapy, see if you can get some shrinkage and make sure they don't bubble up with systemic disease. And then you would go with radiation therapy and then go to surgery. So it's really about the sequencing of the therapies, and you have to put your minds together and figure out what's the greatest risk based on all the assessments you have in your hand. And if it looks straightforward, you know, gosh, it's a recurrence in the rectum, it's stuck to the uterus, all the sidewalls look clean, well, let's just go maybe and take it out and you don't need necessarily any other therapy at that time, but if your lateral margin is going to be compromised, you're certainly going to need radiation. If systemically they're going to be compromised, you're going to need chemotherapy. You really just have to put that whole picture together with the patient present. Make sure you think they can tolerate the various things. Make sure they're going to be responsive. These are all people who failed the first round, right?
Right.
So you have to figure out what new things are we going to do that's going to make a difference, because we already tried chemo, radiation, and surgery, and here they are. They're back again.
Yeah, what do you do intraoperatively? Now you're going for an R0 resection. You think you can get it. You got your IRT all set up and everything, and all of a sudden you're like, uh-oh, this is more than a thing. Do you have your back-out approach? Do you have any things that in mind where are you okay living with that R1 resection? Obviously, in many cases, there's not a whole lot you can do.
Yeah, you know, it goes both ways. I mean, I've been doing this for a lot of years, and x-rays have gotten remarkably better at their resolution, including MRI. So we're better armed going into surgery than we ever used to be. Yeah, I used to have to back out probably, I don't know, maybe 5%, maybe as much as 10% of the time. I'd find additional disease I didn't realize was there. And so I'd open them up and find, oh, they've got peritoneal disease, or they've got additional nodes well out of the pelvis that have nothing to do with this local disease. This is systemic now. And then we'd have to back out. We don't see that much anymore. I can't remember the open and closed situations being significant anymore. But we do find surprises. If the equation, the risk-benefit equation remains essentially the same, I proceed. Sometimes you're almost all the way done before you know whether it's going to work or not. You know, you hope you don't get in that situation too often. If you're up against something like the cava, well, you know, you don't want to commit until you know you're going to be able to get a margin. Because once you get into it, it's hard to get out of those things. So, you try to work your way up to the decision appropriately and not burn bridges before you make that final decision about, you know, whether you can get it out. The worst cases are really the ones that are what I call cavities, the cancer cavities. You know, sometimes you'll see the entire pelvis has a circular recurrence it's kind of wall to wall, and it's necrotic in the middle, and you know those are tough because it's not like you're going in. It's an anti-mass, right? You're not going in to take out a mass with clearly defined boundaries. You go in, you're going in to, you know, kind of remove wallpaper.
And finally, I'm curious as to your thoughts about, you know, the American College of Surgeons' endorsements of Centers of Excellence, specifically as it relates to rectal cancer. You know, you guys have a tremendous amount of experience, and you've had personally a tremendous amount of experience, but do you have any thought on, you know, should we be following this paradigm that they've had established in Europe and other places around, and, you know, they're doing it with other, you know, bariatrics, or you know, whether it's pancreatic cancer or anything, and you know, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's like any other quality program that exists. You know, patients deserve high quality care.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes, you know, surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. So, you know, you should be measuring the quality of the radiation that's delivered. You know, they can do dosimetry and do phantoms and check the radiation. You can see whether or not, you know, a patient gets toxic from chemotherapy and the toxicity rates or the long-term, you know, neurotoxicity that people experience, the hand and finger and toe stuff that they get from oxaliplatin and whatnot. And the same thing's true for surgery. You know, can you get a reasonable local recurrence rate? Are you doing the right operation and doing it well? I mean, I think it's important not just to look at processes, whether you have a committee, whether you have people attending meetings. I mean, honestly, what you want is good outcomes for patients.
Exactly.
So you ought to measure those outcomes. So, you know, Mayo, Charles H. Mayo described the abdominal perineal resection in 1903 in a, I'm trying to remember which journal, so that was JAMA or Lancet or one of those journals, and we've measured our outcomes for rectal cancer for 100 years, and our recurrence rates have never been higher than 9%. They're 5%, 7%, 9% over the course of all these years, with or without radiation therapy, because, of course, from 1903 to 1990, you know, we really didn't do radiation therapy. So mm-hmm. all the data before shows the surgery alone results, and they've been excellent. And I like to think that, you know, that's because of our surgical technique. And I know it is because we all practice the same. And we learned it from Mayo, who ran it down to Charles Dixon, to Oliver Beers, and, you know, on and on to all my current colleagues. So we have good results. I can't speak for outside of us, but I think it's about specialization. You know, Europe didn't have specialization. I think a lot of people don't realize there's a bit of a confusion between what happened in Europe when, you know, people used to do a little urology, a little ortho, a little general surgery. And even if they did general surgery, they didn't really specialize. They certainly didn't have boards in colorectal that much in most of the European countries. And so, you know, some of it's just been the recognition that if you do something repetitively and you get trained well in it, you're going to do well at it. I think in the United States, we've had some colorectal specialty and surgical oncology specialty for a long period of time, so people can really hone their skills. And I think that's really important, you know, recognizing the technical expertise and the multidisciplinary team approach. Those all factor into excellence. So I think it's important to have some quality metrics. I think it's important to have some guidance. And I hope it won't just all be about whether you attend the meeting. I hope it'll be about what your results are.
Outstanding. That transitions very nicely into our next segment, which is the tips and tricks. This is the segment where we get advice from our experts on how to avoid some of those more challenging and sticky situations. I was wondering if you could tell us, you know, you obviously have a lot of experience dealing with very difficult dissections in some very difficult anatomy. How you kind of set yourself up for success with those more difficult dissections when it comes to, you know, planning the procedure, positioning the patient, your dissection, your surgical approach, and if you have any, you know, particular technical tips and tricks for that.
Yeah, so that's a good question in the remaining couple of minutes here. That positioning in recurrent rectal cancer matters immensely because you're on the table for hours. If you're going to do, I mean, a sacrectomy, the average time is 12 hours. Some people do them in two parts, separated 2 different days. And at probably, there's very few recurrent rectals that could be done in anything less than 4 to 6 hours. And if you're going to do an exoneration, you're going to talk 10 hours. So if you have to do any reconstruction, and if you just have to do the IORT itself, particularly if it's brachytherapy, maybe takes a little bit longer. All the different components take time, and so you add all that up together, they're, I'd say, typically a 10-hour case. So positioning matters. You don't want somebody waking up with a neuropathy. So the upper extremities, you got to make sure that they're in a nice functional position. They're not, their wrist isn't stretched one way or the other, extended too much or supinated too much. Padding is really important along the elbow. And in the lower extremity, it's make sure that the foot and the heel gets the weight, not the peroneal nerve, because that's no pressure on the calves, because you'll get compartment syndrome. So peroneal nerve and compartment in the lower extremity are really important. No pressure anywhere down there, so just have to be relaxed on those two areas. And then, when they go in Trendelenburg, of course, they'll shift a little bit. So really make sure that there's nothing touching the calf if you can, and nothing really touching the peroneal nerve is really important. And the upper extremity, it's brachial plexus. If the arms aren't really relaxed at the shoulder level, and if the ulnar nerve and the median nerve aren't protected from getting injuries, those are problems with long surgeries. Also, prolonged Trendelenburg can actually cause blindness. I didn't know that, but we've learned that subsequently. So steep Trendelenburg is not a good thing long term. I think you can use, I don't use a lot of steep Trendelenburg. I use mild to moderate Trendelenburg just to get the light in the pelvis. But if you really just don't want a long duration steep Trendelenburg. So positioning matters a lot. Getting the bottom where you can get to it if you're going to do something through the perineum is also very critical. And being able to move the legs in different positions will make a huge difference, whether the bottom protrudes out at you versus it's tucked away and you can't get to it. As regards working in the pelvis, the recurrent cancers, the most important thing is you don't start like at the top and work your way through the pelvis blindly going down into the pelvis. What you need to do is understand where all the retroperitoneal structures are going into the pelvis. Think about the aorta splitting into the iliacs and the cava splitting into the iliacs and going down to the pelvis. If you don't know where those structures are and you're just kind of working from the top, sorting through all the bowel and trying to get down to the pelvis, you're going to be in them before you find them. So instead, you go to the retroperitoneum wherever you can get into it. That could be at the aortic bifurcation if you have to. You can go all the way up there if you need to. Find those structures, follow those structures down, and make sure they're out of harm's way, particularly if a tumor's up near the S1 area. You've got to find all those structures or you'll be in them. And once you get into a radiate iliac vein, it's very hard to extricate yourself. That becomes a life-threatening bleeding source pretty quickly. They're fragile. Mm-hmm. When they're radiated, their prior surgery means they're splayed out, so they're not soft and easy to work with. And the ureter as well, you find the retroperitoneal structures. And once you find the retroperitoneal structures up around the promontory or above, and you follow them down to about the level of S, probably the distal S2, and maybe even mid S2, then you can pretty much know that you're going to start getting out of the hornet's nest of vascular structures, because the iliac vein, can, particularly the left one, crosses over in front of variable regions. It could be just S1 or it can be part of S2 as well. And it can be kind of hidden from view in the fibrosis after prior surgery. So you got to know where it is. Otherwise, like I said, you get into it, you can't really easily get out of it. Have a strategy, know your structures, look at your CT scans, or you got to calibrate your brain with the imaging that you look at every day. I'm calibrated really closely with CT scans. So I can look at a CAT scan, and I can almost exactly tell where I'm going to run into trouble in the operative field. Mm-hmm. because I use the bony landmarks, which are not variable. I mean, anterior structures like bowel, they can move around and not be reproducible, but the bony landmarks, S1 through S5 and the coccyx, are reproducible every case, and you can look at a bone, you can look where they are in the x-ray and correlate that with your operative findings. Some of these tumors are really quite hidden because they're down on the fibrosis. So you got to know your anatomy cold, and you got to be able to tease out the fibrotic pelvis to find the structures, get the bowel out of the way. You know, the bowel, you can't follow the bowel as much as you follow the mesentery.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the consistency comes from. So find your critical structures first, follow the ureter all the way to the bladder, have stents in place, and once you find those things, then you know you're in a safe zone. It's just like if you did an axillary dissection and get the node, you're going to find your vein, your thoracodorsal, your long thoracic, and then you sweep, protecting those structures, and you sweep everything in between. I mean, that's, you know, kind of an old kind of premise for surgery, is find the things you want to keep them out of harm's way, and then go for the stuff you need to take care of.
Okay, that ends our tips and tricks segments for today, and it's time for our final five. So number one, do you play music in the operating room? And if so, what type of music is it?
Nope.
None at all?
None at all.
Okay.
I like a quiet operating room where I can think and focus.
Okay, so part one, so question 1A, if we were to turn on your car radio or your music at home, what would be the number one on the playlist?
Classic.
Classical music.
Great, ma'am. Number two, could you tell us about any interests, hobbies, or hidden talents you have outside the operating room?
I don't have probably any other talents. I'm an avid reader. I love hiking and just being active. Yeah, that's the most I used to sail, but not as many opportunities right here in Rochester for that talent.
I do enjoy sailing in the Puget Sound.
There you go. They used to do the Willamette. I learned on the Willamette River.
Number three, if you could think back, are there any particular vacations or trips that you've taken that have stood out as being your favorites?
Vacations or trips or both?
Either one.
Either one.
So I guess my best vacation probably of recent that I can remember, they're all great, but I went to Northern Italy with an Italian friend. And our family and her family, my family and her family got together, and we went to Mount Blanc and the Italian Alps, and we went to the Lake District in Italy, and we had phenomenal food. We had great hiking. We did a helicopter trip up to one of the hostels up in the mountains where we had a local meal prepared, and we got a walk on the glaciers, and it was just a phenomenal vista. We did other hiking in the Alps, and then, of course, for a completely different view, we went to the Lake District and did boating and nonstop swimming. Our kids just loved, and the villages we walked in and the gardens we got to see, and some of the history was just absolutely beyond this world.
That sounds awesome. Number four, what would you have done if you did not become a surgeon and didn't go into medicine?
Probably biology. Probably I would have found the ecology world and gotten into that. That was my first plan was biology. My backup plan was medicine. And somehow it reversed. I didn't know about medicine until my fourth year, I think, or third year in undergraduate school. I sort of was a latecomer to it. I was a latecomer to surgery. I didn't know about it until I did my rotation, and probably would have just done ecology, biology work.
Great. And number five, if you could go back to yourself on your first day of internship and give yourself one piece of advice, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
You know, the advice I got from all my predecessors was really the best advice. I mean, I couldn't think of anything they didn't tell me. You got to love it. You got to want to do it. It's got to be in your blood. And if it isn't, find another profession, I think.
That's actually very sage advice. And we cannot thank you enough, Dr. Nelson. This ends up the podcast interview here at Behind the Knife. And we appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us and sharing your words of wisdom, not only about recurrent rectal cancer, but about the colostrum and about leadership as well. And so thank you very much. And we look forward to hopefully one day being able to have you back on.
Very good. And I'll look forward to hearing how it came out.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.